at this time of year, unless you have locked yourself up in your house and never come out, it is impossible to avoid the great summer holiday festival known as Christmas. Its symbols and sounds intrude into absolutely everything. What people wear, what people talk about, what people eat, what's decorating the shops and houses, what music is playing on the radio, and what's arriving in your mailbox and your inbox. Even here in Melbourne, its ability to impose itself inescapably on our consciousness exceeds that of Grand Final Week on the Grand Prix and Melbourne Cup Day, which is impressive in Melbourne. On the day that this great festival ends, the churches will begin a 12-day celebration of the incarnation of God in Christ, a celebration which somewhat confusingly goes by the same name, Christmas. Unlike the great summer festival, it will go almost unnoticed. To the uninitiated, it will seem really strange that we're not singing Christmas carols here this week, but that we will be on the next two Sundays, when all the Christmas decorations have gone from the shops and the Christmas trees will be lying going brown on the nature strips. I know we sang Joy to the World before, and people have come to think of that as a Christmas carol, but it's actually traditionally an Advent hymn, and it has no Christmas references in the lyrics at all. The relationship between these two festivals has always been a rather confused one. Unlike many of my peers, I don't actually think there's a lot of mileage in the Put Christ Back into Christmas campaign. The two festivals began as separate events, the pagan festival marking the winter solstice in the Northern Hemisphere and including decorated trees predated the birth of Christ by centuries. The attempt to merge the two celebrations into one was only ever partially successful, and it's completely collapsing again now that the flawed idea of a Christian society has been largely discarded. I'm not at all opposed to participating in the secular celebrations. I was participating last night. The summer solstice is as good a time as any for a party with friends and family, so enjoy it or endure it, whichever works for you. But at the same time, we are preparing for a quite different celebration of God's miraculous and mysterious presence among us. And that 12-day celebration doesn't even start until tomorrow night. One of the things that maintains the confusion is that both festivals make use of nativity scenes and songs about the birth of Jesus, which grates a bit sometimes, but it's a little bit hard for the church to complain too loudly about this borrowing because we were the ones that initiated the attempted merger, and we did that by borrowing much of the symbolism from the pagan festival and putting it into our celebrations. We tried to swallow their festival into ours, and they responded in kind, and the judges now have them well ahead on points. But the fact that the world has been more successful in paganising our celebrations than we've been in Christianising theirs makes this season of Advent all the more crucial for our spirituality. We have to work a lot harder to hear what God is saying in these stories and songs, because it's nothing like what the local council or the television programmers or the Coles Myer marketing department are saying when they use them. This Advent season reminds us that to understand the story, we need to read it backwards. We prepare ourselves to rightly celebrate the first coming of Christ by reflecting on what it means what it will mean when he comes in glory to turn the world on its head and put all things right. Only in the light of that expectation can we know what we're doing when we come to worship the God who comes to us in the baby of Bethlehem. The story that we heard tonight from the Gospel according to Luke is one of the stories that sounds this warning loud and clear. And it is consequently one of the stories that you're not likely to hear from anyone else but the church. It's also the first story that we've had in this Advent season that actually mentions the baby Jesus, albeit at this stage still in utero. And we'll perhaps get closest to understanding the call of this story to us by comparing and contrasting it to the way that the Jesus stories and songs are used by the secular summer festival. You see, in the shopping mall music and the Christmas card nativity scenes, the one thing that Jesus' presence definitely does not stand for is an expectation of radical, earth-shattering change. Quite the opposite, in fact. He is depicted and sung about in order to keep things more or less the same as they have always been. Although Jesus has no life-shaping significance for the vast majority of Australians and no particular relevance to how they celebrate the festive season, the songs and pictures are retained because they are symbols of continuity with the past. They serve to reassure people that even though the pace of change in our world can be bewildering and disorienting, some things stay the same and can be relied upon to keep staying the same. Even when our planet is beginning to fry and the world is tearing itself apart in war and our kids are resorting to antidepressants and even nice Western democracies like ours deport people knowing that they will be tortured and killed, even in the midst of it all, we can cling to the reassuring certainty that each year we will get to wax lyrical about families and cute babies and sing of peace and goodwill on earth. And Karl Marx thought it was Christianity that was the opiate of the people. The great deception is that the world sings of peace and goodwill precisely to avoid having to make the changes that will be necessary to bring peace and goodwill into reality. Often at this time of year, you will also hear some modern Christmas stories. Perhaps you've heard the one about the soldiers in World War I who heard each other singing Christmas carols from their opposing trenches, and they all emerged from the trenches, shook hands, swapped stories of home and family, and celebrated Christmas Day together. It's a lovely, heartwarming story until you remember that the next day they went back to trying to blow each other's brains out. Their Christmas Day peace and goodwill had served only as a sentimental and reassuring maintainer of normality. And normality includes senseless killing and nations at war with each other. Luke's story of the pregnant Mary visiting pregnant Elizabeth seems almost to be lulling us into another haze of sentimentality. We have two overjoyed, expectant mothers getting together to share their happiness. We have lovely details about the baby seeming to join in the happiness, bouncing for joy in the womb, and the mothers, as mothers tend to do, suggesting that the baby's kicking is actually an indication that the baby is responding with deep theological insight to the events taking place around it. It could almost be any two expectant mothers. It's all cute and lovely, perfect material for affirming that all is well with the world. Peace and goodwill and keep everything safe and nice. But then Mary breaks into song. The chances are it's a song that they already knew and Elizabeth probably joined in as well. Maybe even the babies bopped along in their wombs. But this song changes the picture big time. The words of the song seem to be jarringly juxtaposed against this scene of maternal bliss. And as is pretty much always the case, when the Bible or the liturgy juxtapose things against each other in ways that startle and jolt us, the deepest meaning is in the juxtaposition itself, not in the two parts taken separately. Two things which seem to resist being put together, like two same pole magnets, need to be held together and kept together until we begin to see God's mysterious truths emerging from the juxtaposition itself. In this song, we have a radical, earth-shattering vision of the world made different. In this song, Mary's vision moves quickly from the Lord being generous and merciful to her, lowly peasant though she is, to God upending the world as we know it, tearing down the powerful from their thrones, trashing the plans and schemes of the proud and wealthy, and lifting up the poor and hungry and crowning them with honour and glory. This is the kind of song that tyrannical regimes go to great lengths to prevent the peasants and workers from singing. From El Salvador to Burma to Uganda, you will find stories of military regimes killing or maiming the poets and folk singers to prevent this kind of song. You will find them violently breaking up gatherings whenever the poor and oppressed begin to sing. Mary's song is just the sort of revolutionary vision that sends shivers down the spines of those who profit from the way things are here and now, especially when they hear the masses starting to sing it. Mary's song is full of visions of prime ministers and presidents and dictators being ousted from power and left with nothing. It's full of chief executive officers being handcuffed and jailed for their profiteering. It's full of millionaire tycoons having to beg on street corners. And it's full of asylum seekers being made welcome anywhere and everywhere. The homeless being given the keys to the Toorak mansions, and the fearful and frightened laughing and dancing in the streets with nothing and no one to be afraid of ever again. And what the gospel writer, and indeed this whole season of Advent, is asking us to do is to hold that disturbing, unsettling and wildly hopeful vision in constant tension with this seemingly innocuous vision of a baby about to be born and a couple of blissful, expectant mothers. Actually, most expectant mothers know that a new baby is going to turn their lives upside down and inside out. Life will never be the same again. But the gospel writer wants to drive home to us the message that with the birth of this baby, the whole world will begin to be turned upside down. The status quo, the world as we have known it, is going to be upended as surely and wildly as the money changers tables in the temple. The gospel writer and this season of Advent are preparing us for the Christian celebration of Christmas by sounding the warning loud and clear. Do not kneel and worship this baby unless you are ready to embrace the vision of the whole world remade in the image of God. Do not come and adore him unless you are ready to have your life and your world and everything that you have held dear turned upside down and shaken and reshaped to fit a world where justice and truth and reckless hospitality reign. Do not come with your gifts to honour this newborn king unless you are ready to be caught up in the wind of God's spirit and blown who knows where. Because this sweet and harmless little baby, nestled in Mary's womb, is the one who comes to do God's will, to bring the world to its knees, and to upend the world as we've known it. This baby is the powerful presence of God, whose kingdom will come and whose will shall be done on earth as in heaven. And that's not good news for the retailing giants or the men of war, but it is very, very good news for all who suffer under the weight of the sin of the world and cry out, "How long, O Lord, how long?" How it will happen, we can barely imagine. When it will happen is not ours to know. But that it draws near as surely as the birth of a baby in a swelling womb is our promise and our hope and our deepest, craziest desire.